and good afternoon, and welcome to a WFPL News special. I'm Gabe Bullard. With me today is 3rd District Congressman John Yarmuth. Congressman, thanks for being here.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Gabe.
And we're going to talk about the debt and federal spending this segment, and we want to hear from you. Give us a call at 502-814-8255 to talk with Representative Yarmuth. You can also email news at WFPL.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter at WFPL News. Congressman, I want to start with something we just heard in the newscast, some late-breaking news about the appeals court judge saying calling for an end to busing, the student assignment plan here in Jefferson County.
Well, first of all, I would want to know exactly in what context the judge made that statement, whether he was actually speaking in a legal context, because I don't think there's a lawsuit in state court about that, or whether he's just making a political statement. If he's just making a political statement, he's entitled to do that, but I don't know that it has any more relevance than you or I commenting on that. And what I would take issue with him, at least as the report indicated when he said it was for desegregation purposes, technically that's not why we're busing children in Jefferson County Public Schools, because the Supreme Court said we couldn't do it solely for desegregation purposes. Race can be a factor in a school assignment plan, but not the sole factor, and that was the basis on which our former system was overturned. So, again, I'm not sure we should pay much attention to it until there's actually litigation that this particular justice has any jurisdiction over.
Is this something that a lot of people ask you about, it being in your district, even if it's not necessarily a federal issue?
It doesn't really come up very much, and I suspect that's part of the reason. I suspect the other part is that overall the people of this community recognize that diverse schools are important. They're comfortable with an assignment orientation that has evolved over the last 30 years now. And so I just don't think it's that big of an issue.
So do you support the current plan?
You know, I haven't studied it in depth. I know the criteria that the board was trying to use in assigning students, and I support the goals of that. I don't know whether this is the best plan or not. That's kind of outside my area of expertise.
All right, and that's something we'll be following in the news later today and have on the air in the newscasts this afternoon. We'll go ahead and get started with the regular topics here. This is your first time coming back on the air here since your third term started, and your first time since now you're in the minority in Congress. How's your job been different so far?
Well, it's a lot different, and I can't say that it's more fun, because it isn't. Being in the minority in the House of Representatives is not enjoyable. We don't set the agenda, we don't set the schedule, and we have basically no legislative power, particularly in this era of polarization and ideological polarization. So it's not as much, it's not as gratifying in a policy sense as it was when we were in the majority and we actually could determine the agenda. But there are other things that become equally important and valuable, and that is being the loyal opposition and raising objections when the majority tries to overstep, and which they have done on numerous occasions. And it gives me just as much reason to spend more time dealing with my district and my constituents and listening to their concerns and trying to reflect those in what I do in Washington.
And speaking of disagreements, you voted against the Budget Control Act, and we saw a lot of the partisanship coming out, especially over the least last few months with the debate over that and over the debt ceiling. Can you explain your vote against the Budget Control Act?
Sure, and I think it's really interesting that people think that this was a partisan vote, because I voted the same way Rand Paul and Jeff Davis did. There was a letter to the editor of the Courier from Jim Segrist, who's a longtime friend of mine, and criticizing me for casting a partisan vote. And I said, well, that's interesting, because I voted against the president, I voted against Nancy Pelosi and against Steny Hoyer and with Rand Paul and Jeff Davis. So it's kind of hard to actually say this was a partisan divide. There's no question, because in the vote there were as many almost as many Republicans who voted for it as against it, and similarly with Democrats. So this broke down in multiple ways, and certainly the reason that Rand Paul and Jeff Davis voted against it were probably different than the reasons I voted against it. I voted against it for three reasons. One, the process was indefensible. It was done in secret. It was basically three or four people who negotiated these very significant steps. We got the bill at noon on the day we were voting on it, 6 hours later. So it was impossible to tell in any depth what was in it. And again, when you're dealing with significant programs that affect millions and millions of people, you don't want that done in secret. There's no transparency there at all. That was number one. Secondly, I think the process that was set up with this super committee and so forth is kind of a sham. I may be wrong, and I hope I'm proven wrong, but I don't believe that this group can come up with, or any group could come up with, a proposal that can pass two houses of Congress at this point, because we haven't been able to do much that passes both houses. And finally, the cuts that were in the proposal were neither balanced nor were they real. All we're talking about doing is cutting a very small percentage of projected increases in spending. And all of those cuts in this budget fell on moderate and low-income people. And there was no attempt to balance it with shared sacrifice so that corporations and billionaires pay their fair share. So those were all the reasons that I voted against it. Now, all that being said, you know, I voted it for two other ways of raising the debt ceiling. And one was a clean vote just to raise the debt ceiling, which is basically what we've done for 70-something times since the Kennedy administration. And I voted for the Harry Reid proposal, which I don't want to get into too many weeds, but that came from the Senate. So I was not prepared to let the full faith and credit of the United States go down and default on loans because of this vote. And if I had been the needed vote to or the pivotal vote as to whether it passed or failed, I would have voted for it. But all in all, this was not the way to approach it. The process was bad, and I think the substance was bad too.
And you talked a little bit about this. It's not necessarily partisan. There's polarization happening. But you had said in a previous interview, I forget with which news outlet, that this shows that there's an ideological rift in the Republican Party. But given a lot of the frustrations we hear coming from the left about the actions of some congressional Democrats and even the splits in the Democratic Party, is there a more of a pragmatic rift there in your own party? Because we are seeing some Democrats giving in on what were the sacred cows of the party, some of these programs that had long been hallmarks of Democratic legislation.
I think there is a difference of opinion among the Democrats on this, and I actually am aligned with those who think that we ought to be talking about long-term changes and particularly in Medicare, which is a huge problem. We shouldn't take those off the table from day one. You may recall in the Simpson-Bowles Commission recommendations, which came out last winter, they proposed that we raise the retirement age, or the age at which you get full Social Security benefits, to 70 in 2075. And our leadership basically rejected that out of hand. I thought that was irresponsible. The idea that we wouldn't even consider whether or not to raise the retirement age for people who aren't even alive yet seemed to me to be silly. We have to consider those things. So, but there is a difference in our party. We have some people who say don't touch Social Security or Medicare under any circumstances, in any way. And I disagree with them. But there is a difference. Yes.
Is that changing how your party goes into negotiating then?
We'll see. I don't believe that, at least from the House Democrats' perspective, that Jim Clyburn and Chris Van Hollen and Javier Becerra, who are three designees to the committee, were sworn in blood to oppose any changes in the entitlement programs. I don't believe they were. Now, they may have been. I wasn't in on the conversations between Leader Pelosi and the three of them. But there's no question that they are going to resist changes in programs that impact low and moderate income Americans and senior citizens and kids if there is not a shared sacrifice from the people who have done extremely well in this country over the last decade.
Given the makeup of the rest of the super committee, do you think that there's room for that sort of compromise?
We'll see. There are those who say, and I was on a program with Brett Guthrie earlier today, and Brett raised the point that one of the things that will help move some kind of flexibility and compromise on this committee is the fact that there are Republicans, for instance, who don't want to see an automatic across-the-board cut that affects defense spending. And he may be right. I still don't think it's going to I just think the odds of anything being acceptable to both houses are pretty long. And again, I don't know whether I hope I'm wrong or not. So I don't know which I'd rather see, but I do know that it was set up in a way that they thought they were putting sufficient pressure on all the members, both Republicans and Democrats, both conservatives and liberals, to moderate their positions somewhat. We'll see if that works.
And what would be unacceptable in terms of cuts recommended by the committee? Unacceptable to you?
Well, I think if as in the debate over the continuing resolutions that we have had, all the money comes from programs that are in non-defense discretionary funding, which basically is all the programs that fund education and housing and human services like childhood nutrition and Pell Grants and those things. If all the cuts come from those programs and nothing from defense, and again, that nothing from the tax subsidies that we give to agribusiness and to oil companies and so forth, then that would be unacceptable. I'm willing to look at cuts as long as they're balanced and they don't fall disproportionately on the people who are suffering the most. And that's what's happened. You know, the average, we'll get back to this, I'm sure, but in from 2007 to 2009, the household income of the average American family dropped in absolute real terms by $8,000. That's unbelievable. That's almost a 15% reduction in family income across the entire spectrum of middle class and lower and the lower income Americans. Certainly didn't hit the upper 2%. But so now we're going to budget to balance the budget or try to reduce the deficit based on programs that help them. That makes no sense. And I think that's an immoral approach to take.
And there is a comment that we got, an email from Jennifer. She appreciates your vote on the debt ceiling, on the Budget Control Act. And she says, can you please talk your fellow congressman into demanding that a raise in revenue is a must to get out of this recession?
Well, certainly. And I've been pretty outspoken about that and will continue to be. Senator McConnell loves to say, and he said it 1,000 times if he said it once, that we don't have a revenue problem, we have a spending problem. Well, that's irresponsible, and if he actually believes that, then he doesn't understand the federal budget, because there are two sides to the federal budget. There is an expense side and there is an income side, just as there is with every balance sheet and every income statement. We are at the lowest rate of taxation in this country as a percentage of the economy and as a percentage of income that we've been in 60 years. And so, yes, we have a spending problem. We spend more than we take in, but we're not taking in nearly as much as we used to. Part of that's the economy, but most of it's not the recent economic trend. Most of it, and there have been study after study about this, are the two wars we're fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq, the Bush tax cuts, which was basically a $4 trillion cut in revenue over 10 years, and the prescription drug plan, which we're still paying for, and there was never an income offset for that expense. So we still have to deal with those things because those impacts are ongoing. And part of that was we said we're not going to take in as much revenue, and that's why we have a greater deficit. That is just math. That's not policy.
You had said that you don't see any plan coming out of this committee being able to clear both chambers. Would revenue increases make that even a tougher sell?
It would make it a lot easier sell for Democrats if there were, again, a balanced approach. Simpson Bowles said 3-for-1 in the grand 3-for-1 spending cuts to increased revenue. And that's what the president was trying to negotiate with John Boehner before that fell apart. Now, it would make it very, very difficult if there are actual revenue increases that are obvious for it to pass the House, because every Republican, I think without exception in the House, has signed the No New Taxes pledge. So it makes it very difficult for them to vote for something that would raise revenues.
And going back to some of the programs that could be cut, something that's important to us here and that's also important to a lot of our listeners, public broadcasting funding. Is that something you see going on the chopping block?
Absolutely. I think that That's in that category of non-defense discretionary spending, which in total is about 15% of the entire federal budget, but it includes, again, education, housing, road building, infrastructure, all of those things. And those things have been on the chopping block. They will continue to be. And if the super committee process fails, then the additional $1.5 trillion worth of cuts that go into effect in 2013 will be across the board. Basically, everything gets cut 2%. So, you know, that might be a better scenario for public broadcasting than the super committee working, when the odds are that there won't be, the cuts wouldn't be as balanced, and they probably wouldn't touch defense. Under the trigger scenario where there are automatic cuts, defense bears half of the burden of the cuts.
Talking about the actual process of the super committee, you had signed a letter saying they should be more transparent. Could you explain that a little bit?
Right. What I want to make sure, and this is not without precedent, it's been done several times before, starting with the TARP process and others, is that we want every meeting of the super committee to be broadcast or to be streamed live. We want access to whatever legislation that they produce, budget they produce, 72 hours before there's a vote, and we want to make sure that every contact that those committee members have with lobbyists and all the campaign contributions that they get because they're on that committee are publicly available and publicly disclosed. I think there's too much at stake here to allow any aspect of this process to be done in secret.
Do you think there's a level of distrust from the public of the super committee? There was a story in Politico this morning about Representative Fred Upton, a member of the committee from Michigan, who had a town hall meeting. And essentially the reaction from his constituents was they wanted to see spending cut, but as soon as a specific program was named, they would oppose it. So do you think that's representative of the public at large?
Oh, well, it clearly is. And all the polls show that, and they have historically. If you ask people, should we cut spending to balance the budget, huge majorities will say yes. Then you ask, would you want to cut Medicare? 70%+ say no. Same with Medicaid, same with Social Security, same with defense, same with housing, same with education, same with virtually everything except foreign aid. Foreign aid, they will say they want to see cut. And then if you ask in separate questions, how much do you think is the right amount to be spent on foreign aid as a percentage of the budget? The answer historically has been about 10%, and we actually spend 1%. So there are huge disconnects here, and that shows you the difficulty we have in actually devising a budget that is supported across the board. It's very, very difficult to do.
What do you think should be cut if cuts have to be made?
Well, I think the first place we look, defense, we have to look at. It's 20% of the budget, and we have forces in 100 countries. We have duplicate weapons systems. We have all sorts of waste in the way we spend money in the Defense Department, as we probably do in every department, but everybody's heard of the $1,000 toilet seat and all of those things that there's no excuse for that. So there's plenty of room to save money in defense. And then you go to some of the programs that are what we call tax expenditures. And these are programs where you pay subsidies to agribusiness when they don't need it, when you give subsidies to oil companies amounting to about $10 billion a year, and when they're making record profits. There are a number of instances in which the tax code is spent and therefore tax dollars spent to subsidize businesses that don't need it and that actually benefit a very small percentage of a particular entity. 75% of the farm subsidies go to 10% of farms, and those are the agribusiness farms, and the vast majority of single-family farms don't get anything or get very little.
And we're talking with Congressman John Yarmuth on this WFPL News special. This brings us to our first break. We'll be back in just a minute. What are your thoughts on the debt ceiling? Give us a call, 502-814-8255, or what are your thoughts, rather, on debt and federal spending? 502-814-8255 is the number to call. You can email news at WFPL.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter at WFPL News.
Support for WFPL comes from the Kentucky Bluegrass Music and Burgoo Festival at the Water Tower, featuring live bluegrass, bourbon, ragout, and brews. September 3rd through 5th, performances by the Fiddleheads, Hickory and Friends, Hog Operation, the Cumberlands, and more. Tickets include parking. Details at BusigImpactGroup.com. From Baptist Hospital East, where surgeons perform minimally invasive neuroscience procedures, including spine and pituitary gland surgeries to help minimize pain and recovery time and maximize healthy outcomes. More at BaptistEast.com/surgery. Baptist Hospital East. Feel better. Listening to Louisville's NPR News Station, 89.3 WFPL.
And welcome back to a WFPL News Special with Congressman John Yarmuth. I'm Gabe Bullard. We'd like to hear from you. We're talking about the debt, federal spending, other federal issues this hour. 502-814-8255 is the number to call. I want to bring up some other news that happened this morning. The Congressional Budget Office issued its semi-annual report today. It projects that unemployment will remain at about 8% until 2014. One thing that sticks out here is that the Obama administration had promised that the stimulus would put joblessness below that rate. So what does this new report from the CBO say about the effectiveness of the stimulus?
Well, first of all, let me say that when they said that, I cringed. And I think if you ask them now, they will say that was the stupidest thing that basically any administration probably ever said, because that's not something they can necessarily control. And I know the administration officials who did that are sorry they did it. What we know is that this economy has some very, very serious, fundamental, long-term problems. And one of the main problems is, as I mentioned early on, is that we've had a middle class and that has not seen its purchasing power keep up over the last decade. And when you take, as I said, the average family's income over 2 years dropped $8,000. When you take $8,000 times 120 million families out of the economy, you basically don't need to know anything else about what's wrong. Now, the question is, how do you restore economic vitality and growth in 96% of the American people on a short-term basis? You can't do that. And if you don't do that, then why are businesses going to hire? Why is anybody going to hire at that point? So that again, there's no easy short-term answer to that. The government can spend money to create jobs. We can, and I think we should, commit money to building infrastructure. That puts people to work very quickly, and it would put people to work from one of the segments of the economy that has been hardest hit, which is construction workers, because of the gap in home building as well as all other construction. Beyond that, we have to wait for certain things to create jobs. One thing I think we can do that might help on a shorter-term basis is have the government figure out a way to get money to small businesses, because I know that small businesses are having a very hard time getting loans to expand and to hire more people, and they are much more likely to hire more people than a big corporation. We haven't enforced, and this is another thing I actually recommended to the White House the other day, we haven't enforced the antitrust laws essentially in 30 years. What happens when big companies merge or acquire one another is that jobs get killed. We know that. It's just documented time after time after time, particularly in most recently in the financial services business. Banks merge, 5,000, 10,000, 30,000 people get laid off. And so we have to look at the question of whether we are hurting employment by allowing these huge combinations of power that concentrate, again, more power than I think is safe in an economy. So there are things we can do right now, but by and large, until we get the housing crisis solved and work through so many of these homes that are in foreclosure, get the housing market on firmer footing, and until we can increase consumer demand in the economy, there's no likelihood there's no reason that there's going to be a substantial increase in employment. And that's very sad, but I think that's the situation we're in.
The CBO report also assumes a couple things. It assumes that spending will go down, but revenue collections will go up, largely through the Bush-era tax cuts not being extended. Is that too tall of an order? Is that too big of an assumption for the CBO to be making?
That the Bush tax cuts will not be extended?
Right.
I think that's what the CBO does, and you have to understand what the CBO does. They really don't exercise a lot of judgment in their but that's the way they are. It is prescribed that they operate. So they have to take the law as it exists and say, here's what will happen. Well, the law as it stands right now is that in December of next year, the Bush tax cuts expire. That's $4 trillion worth of revenue that will come back into the Treasury over the following 10 years. If that, but the president has said that he doesn't want to raise taxes on anybody making under $250,000. Well, a lot of that $4 trillion is taxes that would be paid by people making under $250,000, probably 3/4 of it. So that's going to be a policy decision that will have to be made at that time. But CBO is just basically saying, here's what the law is, and we have to proceed on what we think, on what we know the law is, not what we think might happen politically at some point. So again, I find it hard to believe that any combination of circumstances would exist that would restore the higher tax rates on people of moderate middle income. I think it is almost certain, and it should be certain, that we take those people who are making at least $500,000 or $1 million a year and we ask them to pay a little higher tax rate. They've gotten that break for 10 years under the Bush tax cut. They can pay a little more.
And speaking of the spending power of middle-class Americans, Gerald is on the line from the Highlands with a question about personal debt, student debt. Gerald, hello. Gerald, are you there? I suppose not.
Here.
There he is.
Hello?
Okay. Yeah, hello.
Hey, Gerald.
Yes, John, thank you for your service. It's wonderful to talk with you all today.
Well, thank you for calling in.
I wondered about, there was a trend 15 or 20 years ago where a lot of people were encouraged to go back to school and get federal student loans, and now that a lot of them have worked for, 10, 15 years and not even got cost of living raises or are out of work for 2 years, what's going to happen with those student loans? Because, I mean, there's people I know with $50,000 worth of student loans, and they can't even, they've been renting for years and can't even get help with a deposit to be first-time homeowners. So you get this collision of people, you know, the way changing demographics and people divorcing and separating and all that. It's those are my two areas of concern. How can we help people make that 20% deposit and be first-time homeowners? And secondarily, the biggest question I had was about the school loans, that, I find those being issues that resonate with people in their late 40s and 50s, and then they're going to reach retirement age and still have school loans.
Well, again, this is one of those nuances of our economy right now that makes recovery very, very difficult. All of these things pile on, and they do make it harder for people to get on firmer footing. We've done a number of things over the last 5 years, at least when we were in the majority, when the Democrats were in the majority, to try and ease the burden of student loans. We cut the rate of interest in half. We provided for some loan forgiveness programs for those people who decided to go into what we call vital public purpose careers, like police work or teaching or nursing and so forth, where if you work for 10 years in those professions, you actually get all of your student loan forgiven. So we're trying to deal with that. We tried to deal with it, and I know it's a very serious problem. I don't know what the rest of the answers are. Unfortunately, a lot of people turn to bankruptcy to try and get rid of those things, and the federal government eats a lot of those loan guarantees. But most people who take them out are self-respecting, and they don't want to default on them and want to pay them back. But I know times are hard. But if you got a possible way out of this, let us know. Right now, under the Republican rule in the majority in the House, and also with our rules, if we were to do anything, any kind of additional loan forgiveness program, we would have to, by law, come up with an offset, which means we'd have to find cuts somewhere else or find additional revenues, and that's problematic. But that's right now, and technically dealing with that in any legislative way would be very difficult.
All right, Gerald, thanks for your call. We also have Charlie on the line in Louisville with a comment on health care. Charlie, hello, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Congressman Yarmuth?
Yes, Charlie.
8 or 10 years ago, thereabouts, when Roscom Kowski was...
Okay, yeah, we have lost the call. Sorry about that, Charlie. If you give us a call back, 814-8255, we'll try to get you back on. He had a question about healthcare, but we've also seen a few emails and comments coming in online wondering about your opinion on the proposed merger of University of Louisville Hospital with Catholic Health Initiatives and Jewish Hospital and St. Mary's Healthcare. There's a lot of questions, as I'm sure you know, about what will happen to some reproductive health issues. The medical school at U of L won't be merging. They've assured everyone that these services, vasectomies, tubal ligations, abortions, and all that will be offered at another facility, possibly. What are your thoughts on this merger?
Well, this is actually the first time I've been asked about it, and I've tried to follow it as much as I can in the media, and I have been expressed my concerns early on in the, after the announcement of the merger was made, that I was concerned about the impact of religious theology on the provision of care and with public dollars. I still have that concern, and I know that from the university perspective, they are very, very, they're working very, very hard to try and resolve this in a way that will guarantee that no one lacks for the kind of care that might be precluded by Catholic theology here. So I hope they can come to a resolution that satisfies everyone. I'm not involved in those discussions, obviously. It has nothing to do with my jurisdiction. I will say, however, that I completely reject the notion that you can hide behind any private entity and say that there are not public dollars and not a public interest involved in this merger. There are clearly public dollars at many different levels, federal, state, and local levels, involved in supporting University Hospital, the University of Louisville, the University Med School. And I think that we have to make sure that any decision that is made with that assumption in mind, with that fact in mind, that there are substantial federal investments in these facilities and in these operations, and that therefore we cannot allow anything to happen that discriminates on the basis of religion.
Do you consider University Hospital a public institution? There is a disagreement right now over whether or not it is.
There is. Yes, I consider it a public institution.
All right. Moving back to the economy, Christian is on the line from Louisville with a question about small business owners. Christian, hello.
Yes, hello.
Yeah, you have a question?
Yes, I appreciate you taking my call, Senator Yarmuth. I'm a small business owner here in Louisville. Currently we have a loan, line of credit with a bank. I'm not going to mention the name, but it is the Bank of Opportunity, is what they call themselves.
I'm sure they appreciate the plug.
We got put into a classification when, you know, the recession hit, and then we got pushed into what's called a workout group. And basically, they want you to go away and make your lives miserable until you refinance or go someplace else. We have not been able to find another bank because no banks are looking at any companies that are not showing huge profits these days. So we've been forced into 6-month forbearance agreements with the bank, and each forbearance agreement just tightens the screws a little bit more. You know, we're paying 16-17% interest on money plus the fees. So any profits that we're making are just being sucked up by the bank. And I'm just wondering, or I guess like to see the government possibly do something to, you know, force those banks or help those banks be a little more lenient with small business owners such as myself. We've had to finance our customers through the recession because most of our customers have lost their mm-hmm. lines of credit with the bank. So I didn't know if there was anything that was currently in the House of Legislature that would assist small business owners in getting out of loans that banks don't want us in anymore.
All right.
Well, I don't think there's a day that goes by that this is not discussed in the halls of Congress one way or another. We understand the problem. I've heard it from analogous stories in many, many areas, particularly in the real estate business, where companies that have actually been developers that have actually been they're perfectly current making loans, and all of a sudden they reappraise their raw ground or their property, and then they have a call for cash, and it makes it harder and harder for them to operate. Two things going on. One, the banks are scared to death. Secondly, the regulators are putting a lot of pressure on the banks to raise their capital requirements, and they're actually, in many cases, serving as kind of secondary loan approval committees. They're looking over their shoulders and second-guessing their lending decisions. I hope the president, I actually sent a suggestion to the president just this week that he consider as part of his job creation plan some mechanism for freeing up capital for small businesses and using community banks, banks that are less than $10 billion in size, to make loans and giving them an incentive to make loans such as the student banks were incentivized to give student loans. Either do that or make direct government loans to small businesses. Have the SBA make direct loans. I've asked the SBA about that. They say they don't want to do it. They say they're not equipped to do it. And I say, well, we need to figure out some way. Let's create another entity if SBA can't do it. The president's talked about a $20 billion fund to make available for loans to small businesses. I think it probably ought to be larger, but we need to move on it. Just to take care of situations like yours.
You mentioned this forthcoming jobs plan that the president is expected to announce. Other things that we're hearing could be in it would be an extension of the payroll tax cuts, new revenue for transportation projects, an extension of emergency unemployment benefits as well. What do you think needs to be in the plan?
Well, I think all of those are you can make a case for all of those, and I'm fine with them. I say throw the kitchen sink, to be honest. Anything you can think of. And again, my concern about the antitrust laws, I think it ought to be part of a program. I think that's a longer term, that might have a longer term impact. But again, I think the most important thing we can do right now is put money where there is a potential to create jobs. That's not to give it to big banks. It's not to give it to big corporations. But I think it is to get it to small businesses. And again, what we're dealing with is a very big lack of demand in this country. And when you're talking about, again, $8,000 times 120 million families, that's an awful lot of money. There's probably a gap of somewhere between 10 and 20% between what this economy is capable of producing and what the demand is. And that gap is what needs to be filled one way or another. And right now, the only way that can be filled is, I think, through government activity. And I will say that while you get a lot of the debate in the national on the cable channels, and you hear it from the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and a lot of big national advocacy groups, you talk to business people. As we had a White House Business Roundtable here a couple months ago with the GLI put on, and I was there, and these are business leaders from across the community. All they talked about was the need for government to stay in the game, the government to fund infrastructure, to fund research, to fund education. They didn't want the government backing out. And the reason is government spending represents 25% of the national economy. And right now we can't afford to take that money out of the economy. And I know you got a break, but I want to say one thing real quickly that people say, and you hear a lot of rhetoric, well, government doesn't create jobs. In this community alone, if it weren't for the federal government, Humana might exist, but it would not exist in any way like it is now, because 75% of Humana's business is administering government programs. UPS wouldn't exist. to any extent, and neither would U of L. And those are our three largest employers. So, yes, the government does support. Maybe they don't create, but they support many, many jobs in this community and throughout the country.
But given that argument, what do you think the possibility of any of this passing Congress is?
Well, we'll see how good a sales job the president does. And, you know, I think one of the problems is that the president, I'll be very honest, you know, I'm a supporter of the president, but I think the president has not been nearly forceful enough in making the case for government activity and investment. I know that he, as well as everybody else, is, I hate to use the word gun-shy, but gun-shy after the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act, because so many people say, well, that was a failure. Well, it didn't fail. It actually did what it was supposed to do. Without it, there'd be, most economists agree, about 3 percentage points more in unemployment rate. But he needs to believe in his plan, and he needs to get out and sell it forcefully. And he needs, and I think this is why he's doing it, he needs to contrast it with the proposals that are coming from the other side politically, and basically, which just cut taxes and get out of the way. That hadn't worked.
All right, and we'll get back to this in just a minute. You're listening to a WFPL news special.
Support for WFPL comes from University of Louisville School of Music, presenting the 19th Annual Faculty Gala Concert this Friday at 8. The concert will feature performances by faculty artists at the school's Comstock Concert Hall. Donations to the scholarship fund will be accepted at the door. Information at louisville.edu/music. Listening to Louisville's NPR news station, 89.3 WFPL.
All right. Welcome back to a WFPL news special. I'm Gabe Bullard. I'm joined by 3rd District Congressman John Yarmuth. We were just talking about the president possibly not doing as good a job of selling some of his policies. And one thing I would want to ask, we've heard a lot of Democratic members of Congress coming out and saying that it's important for the president to get behind these initiatives, even if it looks like they won't pass. Are you among that school of thought?
I am. I think the other way is basically to just surrender. It's not necessarily to surrender a principle or a position, but it's to surrender the microphone. And when you're not willing to stand up and argue forcefully for your position, then you cede the ground to those who want to go the other way. And that's, I think, happened too many times. I think one of the big mistakes, by the way, in the debt ceiling debate was that the president and others allowed the merger of our short-term economic problems with our long-term economic problems, and trying to accommodate both of them in one policy or one piece of legislation. And they're very, very different. The dynamics that we face right now, going for the next couple of years at least, with a recession or near-recession economy, demand a whole different set of responses than our long-term spending mandates, and we allowed those debates to be merged into one, and I think that was very unfortunate.
And speaking of the tone of the debate and the president and Congress, you came in, you were part of this class of 2006. There was, at the time, shortly after you took office, funding for the wars was coming up, it was on the table. President Bush answered with the surge in Iraq. And what's your thought on how this new, how the Tea Party wave that came in the last election has handled itself, has steered the debate, versus how your class was able to?
I'm not sure that, you know, they've changed the debate a little bit, but they've changed the debate in a way that has made, I mean, they raise important issues. I don't want to deny that, but they raise more philosophical issues. Like when we're debating education for funding, for instance, we'll say we think we ought to be spending this much and doing it this way. They say we don't think the federal government ought to be involved in education. As a matter of fact, people like Senator Paul have suggested we ought to eliminate the Department of Education. There's no negotiating room there. So I think what they've done more than anything is is widen the negotiating room that we have on most issues. I don't think the American people support the extremity that they represent, and I don't think there's much public support for doing away with the Department of Education and ending all of these other programs. But they, again, they've made it harder to negotiate, and they made it harder on their own leadership to negotiate.
And we'll see the test of the public support coming up in the 2012 elections. Hey, you've weighed in a little bit on your thoughts on the GOP primary field. Who do you think is the most formidable opponent right now?
I think the most formidable opponent is John Huntsman. I think he would be the toughest candidate that Barack Obama would have to face because he's moderate and he's reasonable and he looks the part. I think Mitt Romney would be also very tough opponent if he can get through the primary without accumulating so much baggage that he makes himself unacceptable to middle America. The rest of them are totally unacceptable. I think to the American people, they have no chance, and I hope one of them's nominated. Michelle Bachmann, Rick Perry, Newt Gingrich, all these other people, they have no chance to win.
Well, talking about that, how do you think the president's chances are? People are less enthusiastic about him. His approval rating is declining. What could change in the next 16 months to reverse that?
I'm not sure that a lot can change fundamentally to reverse that. I think if the president demonstrates strong leadership skills and points a direction for the country, that will reverse a lot of the decline, because a lot of the decline in his approval rating come from his own people, his supporters, not from they certainly haven't come from Republicans. So I think that is one way. Secondly, there's a great piece that John Ziegler, my old conservative buddy, has in the current issue of the American Thinker. He won't mind my plugging his piece. And it's very long, but it talks about why it is very unlikely that Barack Obama will be defeated next year. And one of the things he talks about is the polling. And he said right now, and he has a background in polling, and he said right now, no Republican, even though some Republicans run, even with a president or run, maybe even I think Romney runs slightly ahead of him, that those numbers right now represent the maximum support that they will get, because as they get into the campaign, their support will drop. And none of them is over 50% right now. So he sees that as an indication that Barack Obama is going to be almost impossible to beat next year. And I tend to agree with his analysis.
Are you planning to seek re-election?
Yes, I am.
And how much longer do you think you could stay in Congress? It sounds like you're less satisfied being in the minority now. Would your political future depend on the majority status?
You know, there's so much at stake right now, and the danger that is represented, in my opinion, by some of the members of Congress, if they maintain their strength or increase their strength, it makes it even more incumbent for what I would consider to be reasonable people, like I can think myself to be, stay in the fight and make sure they don't prevail. So, you know, I had a great uncle used to say, I don't even buy long play records. He's talking about how he never makes long-term plans. So I don't really think much past the next election, but this is no time for me to give up this fight. Again, I think the stakes have gotten higher, and even though I may not be having as much fun in the minority as the majority, there's still hope. We might be in the majority next year as well.
Going back very quickly to a policy issue here, we have Steve on the line in Louisville asking about tax cuts. Hello, Steve.
Hello.
Hi, Steve.
Hello. Why don't the Democrats make a stronger argument that tax cuts have no relationship whatsoever to hiring people? Hiring is based on demand. And in fact, tax cuts tend to create an incentive for businesses to reinvest in their business rather than to pay themselves more and end up paying more in taxes.
Higher tax rates actually are an incentive for them to keep the money in the business.
That's right.
Yeah, exactly. You took my words out of my mouth. I've made that case many times. It is frustrating when people say, and they do it all the time, my political opponents will say, oh, higher taxes mean, you know, I'm not going to I'm not going to do this. I'm not going to do that. I've been in business. My brothers are both in business. My sister's in business. My father built a very big business. Not one of us has ever made a business decision based on tax rate. And if you get any self-respecting business person, when you get them in private, will tell you that that's not what motivates them. You're absolutely right. If they see an opportunity to make money, they will take that opportunity. If they don't see an opportunity to make it, or if it's too risky, then they won't. The tax rate is irrelevant.
And we're not going to have time to get to all these calls here, but Joe on the line from Louisville does say that 37% of the stimulus package went to tax cuts.
That's a very good point. Most of the money actually in the Recovery Act went back to people, either in, again, 37% went tax cuts to 95% of the American people. They got it through their withholding, so most people aren't aware that they got it because they got it in $15 increments every 2 weeks. And another third of the stimulus went to basically to shore up state and local governments so they could keep teachers on the job and public employees and pay the unemployment benefits and bolster and shore up Medicaid funds and so forth. So it all went back to citizens, the vast majority of it, and then about a third were in public projects.
And I know it's getting into a crunch here, about 30 seconds left. I just want to summarize a few emails and calls that came in. People ask about caps on, term limits, paid vacation for Congress members, and pay for Congress members.
Well, actually, pay for Congress, I know a lot of people, there's a lot of stuff going out on the internet that says we vote on our own pay raises. We don't. It's actually set by a commission. We vote to reject them, which we've done 3 out of the last 4 years, which we haven't gotten given ourselves a pay raise. And in terms of paid vacation, I mean, we get an annual salary, and we don't get a necessarily, we really don't have any vacation days. We work, and then sometimes we are off. I don't think we have any stipulation as today's. And forget the final point, but a lot of the stuff that, you know, people say we have these extravagant retirement plans and so forth. We basically have the same plan as every federal employee, and it's no different.
And I'm going to have to end it here. Thanks a lot for your time. Thanks to our callers. Sorry we couldn't get everyone in, but thank you, Congressman, for being here.
Thank you, Gabe.
And this news special was produced by the WFPL News staff, including Philip Bailey and intern Kaysen Riley. Our production team is led by Brad Yost and Laura Ellis. For more information, WFPL.org. I'm Gabe Bullard.